detective sergeant in a homicide.
Oh, you have to, Speedy. I was crawling in so I wouldn't disturb.
Want to check it for a minute, Mike? Say hello to... made up of only Sector, Lebovitz, and Paul. And before I went in and saw them dead, and the fact is, told me who had been killed. And I had them, whereas everybody knew, through publicity and activities, the Purple Gang and the individuals who comprised the gang. But the Little Navy Gang heard of. And look, I was supposed to know all these people, and I had to stop and think, well, who are they, and where did I see, hear about him? And, you know, it took me a little time to place them. So they had, and they lived in, not lavishly at all, they lived in small apartments in the inner city. The inner city then was a little different from what it is now. See, that was 40 years ago. The buildings hadn't had 40 years longer to run down. But they lived on streets, near Harper and Grace Hospital, like Orchestra Place or Alexandrine, other streets that run near, that run east from Woodward. In apartments there. And it wasn't that there, of course it wasn't the great affluence in the underworld then because of the Depression, but a lot of gangsters were making an awful lot, or taking in a lot, an awful lot of money with Prohibition, with gambling.
Do you accept as accurate the statement that the reason the Little Navy welched on its debt to the Purples was that they had been victimized by, in their handbook operation, by the so-called East Side Mafia?
Well, I don't know it, if that happened. And I think that Sucker, Lebovitz, and Jaime Paul welched on a lot of debts. They were, you know, they were, let's face it, they were pretty tough characters, and they probably ran out of money for some reason or other. Maybe they gambled it, maybe they just wanted to keep it, and maybe they said, the hell with the Purples, who are they? You know, you just won't pay them as people did. But I've never heard anything about the so-called East Side Mafia doing any business with them. I sort of have my doubts because any so-called mafia organizations, and at that time there were, I've never known mafia as a word, but there were persons of Italian and Sicilian backgrounds who lived on the east side and the west side of Detroit and were feuding, and they had not gotten together in 1931 at all. They later did. Now, they were underworld people, and I think, however, that they were self-sufficient, that they didn't have to bother with punks like the Little Navy, because, look, these other men were much tougher. And I don't think that they'd have to depend on them for alcohol or anything else. Um, Levine, I think, set the meeting up between the Purples and the others. Incidentally, this says that all the guns were found in those in a paint bucket. My recollection is that only one gun was found in there. That they all, although the bucket of paint, or two buckets of paint, were left outside the apartment door so that the assassins could get rid of their guns immediately. That only one took advantage of it. Now, rumor had it at that time that Harry Fleischer dropped his gun. We've got to remember that Fleischer was never, well, he was charged with being one of the murderers, but never tried, because by the time he came back and surrendered, Sally Levine, the only witness outside of Pollock, had completely changed his story and said that he told a bunch of lies. And they tried to get new trials. So they didn't have, the police didn't have a witness against Fleischer. They couldn't try him because Levine, and then the other witness that they had at the examination, Larry Pollock, who was just driving in the alley as the four Purples allegedly were driving out, and who had identified them at the examination, because he knew them all, had changed his story at the trial and said that, he saw some men coming out, but they weren't these defendants. He'd known them practically all his life. The ones he saw coming out were, he thought were a bunch of Greeks. And he was tried for perjury. And a very top criminal lawyer in Detroit at that time, P.J. M. Halley, Jr., represented him, and he was acquitted of perjury. Yeah, they were unarmed, the three little Navy guys, and they, apart from what they've said to other people prior to the meeting, that they thought they were going to work out some deal with the Purples over the money they owed them.
Do you accept as accurate Wolf's statement that the three victims met Levine and his handbook, and then all four proceeded.
My recollection on that is that Levine went with the Purples, rode up there with the Purples, but that I'm not sure of. He could have ridden with the so-called Little Navy because he set up the meeting, Levine, but I'm not sure of that. My recollection, however, was that he rode with the Purples and that some police, actually I thought it was a cruiser, one of the cruisers, passed him and saw him with the others. And then when after the shooting they went and looked for the Purples because they were some of the people in Detroit that the police would be suspicious of. And when the cruiser detective said, well, wait a minute, Sally Levine was with them. We saw them driving in that direction prior to the shooting. So that's when McMillan, who knew where to find him, about the handbook and Selden, went over there and arrested him. They had two good lawyers, when the thing finally went to trial, Rodney Baxter, the late Rodney Baxter, and the late Edward J. Kennedy, Kennedy represented the Purples during their entire existence, but there's no defense. Levine's testimony was just too strong, plus some of the circumstantial evidence. The manager of the apartment, one of the Purples had gone and rented that apartment specifically for that reason. He'd rented it a couple of weeks before, or a week before. So the thing had been set up. It had been planned a long time. Now, Abe Bernstein was the oldest of the Bernstein brothers. And he was supposed to be the brains of the Purple Gang. Abe was out of the city at that time, and for quite a while. And the feeling in the underworld, this wouldn't have happened, certainly wouldn't have happened that way, because he would not have execution number one, and he wouldn't have approved the execution. He wouldn't approve this type execution. He wouldn't permit his younger brother Raymond to get involved in the thing, or the others. But he was away. Many people felt that way, though, that it just, the combination of circumstances, that one, they were killed, and two, that the others were caught. Circumstances which would have been avoided if he'd been in town.
Who was it, Ray, who rented the apartment?
I don't recall. It was one of the Purples. But I don't recall. We'll have to look that up. I knew at the time who the manager identified. And the apartment was 2649. Or no, the apartment was at the northeast corner of 12th and Collingwood. Still there. Looks about the same. On the outside, at least.
Is the statement accurate that after the murders, the police engaged in mass arrests?
No. I don't know what is meant by mass arrests, but I have recovered stories in Detroit, even where after a certain type crime, murder, I guess, all this. Literally, hundreds of people have been arrested. That I'd consider mass arrests. Now, not all in one fell swoop, but over, just day after day after day. The Goodrich murder of little Lillian Gallagher, that's Gallaher. No G in it. For instance, the murders of girls, murders of some gangsters, where hundreds of people have been arrested. But nothing like this took place. No, it wasn't long before they knew, the police knew who they were looking for. As a matter of fact, I had it in confidence. I had verification of it. I told you how I got the story in confidence. But I didn't print the names of the wanted persons until they were picked up. It was cooperation with the police, although I'm sure it didn't mean anything because the wanted ones knew they were wanted. After Sally Levine was arrested, Must have figured he couldn't hold up under questioning. And Pollock couldn't either, because he testified at the examination. The police tactics then were different from police tactics since the Miranda decision. They used a lot of force often to exact confessions or information.
There is also the statement that in departing the scene with Bernstein at the wheel, the car nearly struck a little boy.
Four-year-old boy, I vaguely recall that, yeah.
Later.
Or a little boy, not 4 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the Wolf story elsewhere says that at the trial, that kid was a witness.
Yeah, I don't think he could recall much of it, almost hit him. I vaguely recall that, but I'm not sure. Let me see, of course, Judge Donald Van Zyl. He didn't have his first name, but it was Donald Van Zyl. V-A-N, capital Z-I-L-E. The late Judge Van Zyl. A recorder's court. A lot of quotes. To the judge when he sentenced the man, and I assume that he said these things. It sounds like him, you know, a lot of cliches about murder is a pretty awful thing. And my, it's going to Detroit a bad name.
Do you recall Keywell requesting the judge to send him to Marquette?
No, I was there, but I don't recall that detail. I don't know why he would have picked him out to send him to Jackson. Unless he wanted to do a favor for somebody, because, you see, Marquette is so far away, it's very difficult for the families to get there, to visit the inmates, if they want to. And that's one of the hardships. It's also supposed to be a rougher prison than Jackson. And it's old. I don't know why he singled him up to send him to Jackson. Yeah, there's another place.
Perhaps because
I know they all went to the same prison. That was Marquette, and that's different now. Now they go to Jackson. They're sorted out and sent from Jackson to another prison. It just, at that time, they would go be sentenced directly to a specific prison. I went to the train, saw them off after they were sentenced. Of course, there was a big, great deal of speculation. Sally Levine was dead and would be killed and in reprisal. I knew something, however, and through the attorneys, that they wanted him, everybody connected with this thing wanted him kept alive and well, because they wanted a retraction from him to base a new trial, which they got. And he said he was forced to testify, as he did. But that didn't really convince anyone. And the men served out their sentences. Milberg died in prison, and Bernstein. He'd had a stroke in prison. He was a very old man. He served 32 years. Keywell served 34 years and was released. And believe me, after that length of time in prison, they come out vegetables, and that's what anyone comes out as, not a human being.
There's also some question about the accuracy of Wolf's report on the subsequent history of Harry Fleischer.
Well,
he has been convicted on a Senator Hooper murder conspiracy.
I didn't think he was. We can check that. Three people went to prison for conspiring to kill Senator Hooper. And they were all close friends of Fleischer's, but I didn't think, my memory doesn't put Fleischer in with them. He might have been, and I can easily check it. By the way, to finish him up with the, I think I said this, but in case I didn't, he disappeared after the Collingwood massacre, and then surrendered something like a year later. I noticed this article says he surrendered at the City Hall. I don't know what the hell he surrendered. Who he surrendered at the City Hall for. I remember the day I was there when he surrendered. I was told about it ahead of time. He surrendered at the prosecutor's office. And he had affidavits that he was in jail at the time of the murder, in some old town in Pennsylvania. But they didn't try him because they didn't have any witnesses by that time. They had any reliable witnesses, because the two who had testified reversed their story. No, I don't call him that. He was in federal prison for, as a matter of fact, part of his federal time was spent at Alcatraz when his brother Louis was there. Louis got an awful long time for having him. He was arrested in Highland Park with an automatic with a drum. It's contained 20 or 40 shells, and it was an illegal gun. But because of his reputation, he got a terribly long sentence. And did I say in there about him, I said earlier about his coming up to see me when he got out?
Mm-hmm.
That's in there, yeah.
This is October 29, 1971. We'll be talking, Ray, about a couple of purple gangsters, one named Abe Axler, A-X-L-E-R, the other Eddie Fletcher, F-L-E-T-C-H-E-R.
These two men were inseparable. They were both about the same height, which was under normal height. Not much more than, I'd say, 5 feet, 4 or 5 inches. Fletcher had been a fighter, and he was fairly stocky. Axler, very sallow complexion, was thin, and didn't certainly look like the tough guy that he was, nor did Fletcher, although they were considered to be, by many, trigger men for the Purple Gang. Fletcher came from Brooklyn, New York, and and he was the only one in the Purples that wasn't a native Detroiter. Now, whether his right name was Fletcher or whether he had it legally changed, I don't know, but he always went by the name of Fletcher. All his arrests were by Fletcher, never anything else. Axler was, and a few others were tried, incidentally, under the so-called public enemy law. When Harry Choi was prosecutor, and the law was declared unconstitutional. If they were convicted, the conviction didn't hold. I don't think they were convicted. But these two were really the tough guys, the ones to be feared most in the Purple Gang setup, despite their lack of muscle. They were very quiet, never spoke to people unless they knew them very well. They were, you know, it was reported that they were responsible for some gang murders, although they were never charged. They were also known as extortionists, and allegedly dealt in narcotics. That again was not proved. Now the Purple Gang did not handle narcotics. They weren't in that racket. These two fellows who were with the Purples were allegedly dealt in dope, and this might have been the reason it was thought at the time, might have been the reason why they were taken for a ride and murdered in Oakland County. That murder was never solved. They were found in an automobile this side of Pontiac, parked in a side road, sitting in the back seat, their arms linked, and two or three bullets in their head. The strange thing about it was that Axler and Fletcher, according to those closest to them, would not have gotten into an automobile with anyone they didn't know and trust. And it was, there was a divided opinion as to whether they were forced or conned into this car, or whether somebody who knew them well and they trusted took them out and set them up for someone else to shoot them. Neither the motive nor the persons responsible was ever definitely established. But speaking of getting in cars, did I talk about the one I talked to dying, the gangster? That's him. I thought they didn't. This might have been a case, of course, of they're thinking they could explain away whatever grievance these people had against them, as was the case in the man I referred to earlier, who was shot and thrown out of a car near Birmingham. Of course, the ones who were doing the gang murders were just doing their job, and they had no interest in the merits of whether the man should die or shouldn't die. They were told to go and dispose of someone, they did it. There is a saying, this was one way to get up in the organized crime structure. You made your bones, the term was. That means that you kill, burn people in the bones. And the more proficient you were, I suppose, the better chance you had of advancement. But none of those gangs, you know, written about Chicago so often that we've had more gang murders than any city, hundreds of them. None or only one was solved. Well, that was true in those days all over the country. Those murders were never solved. For a lot of reasons. The person who did it was one who could be trusted not to talk about it. There were never witnesses. If someone stumbled on the scene, they'd dispose of him too, so he couldn't identify them. And if someone did identify him, he just wouldn't live to testify in court. Or he wouldn't be available at any rate to testify. But they were professional jobs. They knew what they were doing. They didn't wound people. They always used 45 automatics, and bullets were always in the head. And as I say, there are no witnesses.
Was there some special reason why the bodies were always found outside the city?
Well, they weren't until recent years. Many of them were found inside the city in those days. But I think that the murderers learned a lesson that if they took them outside the city, there was less heat on them, because it meant that the Detroit police wouldn't be involved in it because it would be outside their jurisdiction. If so many were found, you know, beyond the 8 Mile Road or just a short distance outside, the gang murders, they'd be taken. Now, many were, as I say, found right in Detroit. But the big reason was that any murder like that in Detroit would bring the Detroit police into it. They knew more about working on these cases, knew who the people were. They gave the all hoodlums a very hard time of it. Their rackets were closed down or harassed greatly. And because the police just didn't want murders in Detroit. Obviously, they didn't want them any place, but didn't want them in Detroit to sully the record. Now, of course, none of that's understood by these people who are killing in Detroit, establishing record. But, yeah, that was a big reason. The police would, there'd be a gang murder, they'd arrest everybody every gangster, and hold them. And if they should get a writ, if an attorney should get a writ on them, they would get it extended in the court, or release them and pick them up again. And they had pretty bad treatment while they were being held. Plus the fact that their handbooks, blind pigs, whatever racket they're in, would be put out of business. They were pretty rough. So they learned that. And when possible, it seemed, they took them outside the city. They might have been murdered in Detroit, but there was no way to establish that. Something happened in that same era when Jerry Buckley was murdered in the LaSalle Hotel. This was, of course, during Prohibition, when every block had its blind pig or blind pigs and handbooks. and there are houses of prostitution then, as well as street prostitution. It was considered a pretty open city. And I didn't think a thing like this could ever happen, but the day after Jerry was murdered at 1 in the morning, and by noon that day, early afternoon, there wasn't a blind pig in the city of Detroit open. There wasn't a handbook open. There wasn't a house of prostitution open. And I learned then that the law could be enforced. Now, the police didn't go around and close these places. That would have taken way too long. There were not enough police. They just sent out the word close, and they closed. It was the only time that I've seen the law is covering vice, gambling, prostitution. And that was prohibition, of course, with all the liquor running and sales illegal. Enforced 100%. I never thought it could be done, and it was then. Now, it probably couldn't be sustained. Gradually, things started opening up again. After the big blast was off, but they remained closed. The bootleggers, some of them, got around it by keeping their place closed. I know one fellow that had a place downtown. He closed his blind pig, but he stood out on the curb and he had half pint bottles of whiskey all through his clothes. He saw them on the street. But really, the town was closed. And probably the only time since Cadillac arrived that it was 100% closed. And I don't think anybody cheated for a few days then. The word went out and the word was obeyed.